From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Advocates worry a new law that lets the state declare groups domestic terrorist organizations unfairly targets minorities.
We stand with the targeted. We stand with the criminalized. We stand with the ones empire tries to bury.
Lawmakers are set to return to Tallahassee later this month to draw new congressional district maps, but not everyone's convinced it's a good idea.
It's possible you end up, instead of a gerrymander, you end up with what we might call a dummymander. You've tried to help yourself, but instead, you've ended up hurting your own party and you lose seats.
Most of Florida is in a drought, and experts say the earliest it could let up is maybe this summer.
Will we continue to add to these deficits and expand the exceptional drought status, or will we start to chip away at these totals? It's still up in the air at this point.
I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. A new state law lets Florida officials designate groups as domestic terrorist organizations. But as WFSU's Tristan Wood reports, advocacy groups worry about the measure unfairly targeting minorities.
The legislation allows the state to target groups, freeze funding, and penalize people who support such organizations. During a recent bill signing, Governor Ron DeSantis said it also prevents Florida's legal system from being influenced by Sharia law and protects residents against Islamic extremism.
Now, we'll do millions for public safety, millions for education, but never one red cent for jihad. So the legislation we'll sign today is the strongest action Florida has ever taken to protect its people from this influence.
DeSantis had already attempted to label groups terrorist organizations before the law was signed. He previously issued an executive order giving the designation to the Council on American Islamic Relations Florida, or CARE. They're currently battling that in court, but DeSantis mentioned them by name at the press conference.
I mean, if there's a school that is allied with CARE, should you have any of your money going to things like that? I think not.
CARE Florida's Chelsea Madriguez says she thinks the law targets Muslims and is a threat to all state residents' First Amendment rights.
Governor DeSantis has effectively authorized the construction of police state infrastructure designed to bypass the judiciary and silence the voices of Florida's minority communities and political dissenters.
Others, like Reverend Andy Oliver with the United Methodist Church of Allendale, share similar concerns.
So when laws like these try to make people afraid, try to brand dissent as danger, and try to silence communities already under suspicion, Christians should know exactly where they stand. We stand with the targeted. We stand with the criminalized. We stand with the ones empire tries to bury, because resurrection means the truth will rise, the silenced will speak, and liberation will not stay in the grave.
Madriguez says CARE does not expect to be designated a domestic terrorist organization under the new law, but is prepared to file another lawsuit if that happens. DeSantis preemptively said he's anticipating a legal fight.
They'll sue us like they do on everything, and we'll win on appeal.
The law will go into effect July 1st. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is calling for lawmakers to redraw the state's congressional maps later this month, which could help the GOP take more seats in the midterms. But Democrats recently won two state legislature races, sounding the alarm for Republicans' prospects. WUSF's Douglas Soule talks about whether those results could affect state leaders' redistricting aspirations.
A regular gathering of Tallahassee insiders. The Capitol Tiger Bay Club offers lunch, conversation, and speeches from top officials. Recently, the members were buzzing about surprising Democratic wins in special elections. One was retired accountant Dean Minority, who says it's hard to know what comes next.
There is no guarantee in politics. There is no guarantee.
That's clear after the elections last month. Democrat Brian Nathan flipped a Tampa State Senate seat. And Emily Gregory flipped a House seat a Republican won by 19 points just 2 years ago. That district includes President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago. But she told WUSF the election was not about her presidential neighbor.
My opponent put President Trump at the forefront of his messaging. The endorsement was on most of his literature. For me, it was about talking about the issues that affect all of us and not one single most famous constituent.
Heather Williams, president of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, which supports campaigns around the country, sees a national trend.
These flips in Florida were our 29th and 30th flip of this election cycle already. State legislative candidates are defying odds across the country because they're laser focused on affordability.
The result also affects what's coming up soon in Florida that could determine who controls Congress after the November midterms. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has called on lawmakers to meet April 20th to draw a new congressional map. It comes as President Trump has pushed other Republican states to redistrict. But one Florida political analyst says the recent special elections could make Republicans think twice.
I think they're still going to look into it. They still might even do it. But I will bet that it will not be quite as aggressive as it would have been.
That's University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett. The catch is that when a party redraws voting lines to capture seats, it can make the safe seats they already hold more competitive.
It's possible you end up, instead of a gerrymander, you end up with what we might call a dummymander. You've tried to help yourself, but instead you've ended up hurting your own party and you lose seats.
Some Florida Republican members of Congress had already expressed doubts about redistricting. And U.S. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries said a Florida map change would help Democrats win seats. But Florida's Republican Party chair warns against reading too much into Florida's recent results. Evan Power says special elections are just that.
I think what we've become very good at as Republicans is voting in regular election cycles. We're not particularly great at these special elections. But that doesn't mean anything come November when all our voters are going to turn out like they normally do and we're going to rack up big wins.
He says there's, quote, clearly room for the legislature to redistrict and so the GOP can pick up some seats. That's an opinion shared by Barney Bishop. He's a lobbyist, a Republican, and a Capital Tiger Bay Club member at that recent lunch. He expects redistricting to go forward.
It's a challenge, but I think the Republican staff will make that happen and present a solid plan, and I think the Republican legislature will adopt it. I think the governor will sign it.
For now, it's just talk at the Tiger Bay Club. How state lawmakers weigh the risk could determine who controls the House. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
We've managed to get a bit of rain recently, but not enough to touch the drought in the Big Bend and much of Florida. Extremely dry conditions have led to burn bans and water restrictions in some areas. Gina Jordan spoke with Florida Public Radio Emergency Network meteorologist Andrew Wolfuck about how long these conditions are expected to last.
If you look at our rainfall deficit this year, since January 1st, we're in the hole between 7 and 8 inches of rainfall. But that's not the whole story. If you look last year, we finished about 13 inches in the hole. So if you add those up, we're about 20 inches in the hole, and that is a lot of rainfall to be down.
Yeah. Can you figure out what's happening with climate patterns that has us in this exceptional drought situation?
It's really complicated because remember, it all started, you know, last year we were in a drought most of the year and now we continued that drought. It's just we haven't seen a significant pattern shift or any type of relief. You know, usually Florida depends on a tropical cyclone to see rainfall and we didn't have any in 2025. Another negative is that we stayed mostly dry towards the second half of last year. So you already have up two negatives and they just keep on piling and piling up on each other. And a lot of the cold fronts we've seen recently have been mostly dry. They've delivered a lot of cool air, but they haven't had a lot of precipitation with them. So until we can really change that pattern, it looks like this drought is going to continue for weeks, if not months, and it's likely to get worse before it gets better.
Ugh, yeah, we don't want a hurricane, but it sounds like we could use a mild tropical storm that moves slowly.
So we're getting to the point where that is the only way I think we're going to be able to make up that deficit is if we have a slow-moving tropical cyclone. You know, it doesn't have to be a hurricane by any stretch of imagination, you know, just a tropical depression, maybe a tropical storm, but slow moving is the key. And if that were to go across the area, we could easily get rid of these deficits. But remember, you know, hurricane season doesn't start until June 1st. And the hurricane forecast or hurricane outlook is going to say we're actually going to be in a reduced hurricane cycle this year, which is technically good news, right? Because we won't be tracking a flurry of activity. But it's also bad news for us in the Sunshine State because we really need that rainfall. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
And so you're saying the forecast in general looks like this drought will stick around for a while.
Yeah, through mid-April, we're only talking about a tenth, maybe a quarter of inch of precipitation across the Tallahassee region. That we should be at several inches of rainfall. So yeah, a quarter of an inch, a fourth of an inch, a half an inch is not going to cut it. It's enough to get the sidewalk wet, but it's not enough to end the drought or give us any type of relief. So at least through April, these deficits are going to continue to add up. Now, remember that our summer wet weather season starts around June 1st in itself. We see those daily afternoon showers and thunderstorms with the sea breeze that comes off the Gulf. So that is our only hope at relief at this point because we're getting in the time of season that cold fronts simply don't make their way this far south, during the late spring, early summer. They're more northwesterly than us, so we don't get in on that precipitation. And then the big question is what happens in May? May is usually that transition month to our normal summertime weather. However, there are some years in which we've seen the early summer be dry. We don't want that, obviously. So, still up for prognostication of how the summer will begin, but how the summer will begin will be key on what happens with our drought. Will we continue to add to these deficits and expand the exceptional drought status, or will we start to chip away at these totals? It's still up in the air at this point.
That was Gina Jordan speaking with Florida Public Radio meteorologist Andrew Wolfick on a segment of WFSU's Speaking Of podcast. Still to come on Capitol Report, one Florida couple is waiting for a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court on birthright citizenship before they decide whether to grow their family.
Maybe in June we have good news.
Getting access to medical care is increasingly difficult for kids from low-income families as some pediatricians opt out of accepting government-sponsored health insurance.
Around all major metro areas, if you look at the lowest income communities, the number of pediatricians is about 50% as the higher income zip code.
And we'll meet a musician honing her craft in South Florida.
Before I came to Miami, I think I was always focused on the voice in music.
One Florida family is waiting for a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court before they'll decide whether to try for another child. WLRN's Tom Hudson has more about their story.
Sean and Michelle waited years to start a family after coming legally to the United States. They immigrated to Florida from Venezuela, where Sean had served in the military before facing threats from the Hugo Chavez regime. They worked, started a business, and had a daughter. But they're waiting to grow their family, waiting on the Supreme Court to decide if President Donald Trump's effort to do away with birthright citizenship is constitutional or not. Among the dozens of executive orders the president signed on his first day in office was a ban on granting U.S. citizenship to everyone born in America.
On January 2025, when the current administration took office, that executive order was one of those that make us feel like terrified.
This is Michelle. Now, that's not her real name. We have spoken with her a couple of times over the past year and a half as she and her husband navigate the shifting immigration system.
We were already married. We waited until I was 36 to have our daughter. So it wasn't something that suddenly happened. No, we plan, we wait, we work hard in our stability, our financial situation. When everything was stable, we decided to have our child.
That was 8 years ago. Today, their daughter is in second grade and is an American citizen since she was born here in the United States. Michelle and her husband, Sean, came to America legally, first claiming asylum, then temporary protected status, and more recently, Michelle was granted an H-1B visa.
It's been a long journey, but we had been always doing things within the law. So in January 2025, things were really, shocked for us because we were trying to have another child.
Florida has a lot at stake with the Supreme Court's decision on President Trump's effort to do away with birthright citizenship. Almost 1 million people from a foreign country have moved to Florida in the past decade. Census Bureau data show 9 out of 10 people moving to Florida last year alone came from overseas. And today, about one out of every five Floridians were born in another country like Michelle and Sean. Now, some have become citizens like Michelle and Sean want to. Michelle told me they've been allowed to apply for permanent residency, a green card. The next step would be to become citizens. The two of them had Venezuelan passports, but they expired several years ago. Like many Venezuelans living here in the U.S., they've been unable to get them renewed due to the rocky diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Venezuela. It leaves Sean and Michelle essentially stateless if they lose their lawful status in America and worry that another child of theirs may be stateless without birthright citizenship. Michelle says they're racing against the clock, not for their immigration journey, but for their family planning.
I'm talking about biological clock. I'm 44. So, of course, I had visited my doctors, everything. They said, you're not old, you're not old woman, you still can, don't worry. But I don't know how long I can wait. Maybe in June we have good news and we don't have to wait to become a resident. Imagine all this stress. Because usually women, you know, we want to have a baby. And for some reason, it's not possible because the age or because the so many things, right? The stress is a key factor. So imagine the normal stress of a woman, but now this super stress on top. If it's something that is going to be for good, God is going to allow us to do it.
She and Sean speak often about their faith when talking about their immigration efforts. It's a faith Michelle says she now hears from their daughter.
When that little girl prays for a sister or brother, even she says in her prayers, it doesn't matter if it's a boy or a girl. I just want someone to play. Yeah, it's heartbreaking, but you know, we cannot control that.
For now, Michelle says they're working toward their green card and waiting for the Supreme Court.
We are stressed and worried about an unborn child legal status. Yeah. It's exactly like that.
It's a decision that's expected this summer. I'm Tom Hudson.
In Florida, there are more than 4.5 million children enrolled in Medicaid. This ensures their access to comprehensive, low-cost health coverage and is a vital safety net for low-income families. But pediatricians are not legally required to accept Medicaid, leaving some families to conduct extensive legwork to find a provider. It can also lead to long waits for appointments or traveling long distances. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford spoke with Chris Johnson of Bluebird Kids Health about how finding doctors who accept Medicaid coverage has become a challenge for families.
Chris, can you first explain what is Medicaid and how it differs from Medicare and who it is supposed to help?
When you think of the U.S. healthcare system, there are three primary payers of healthcare services. Medicare, which provides insurance for people who are 65 and older. Commercial insurance, which most folks receive through their employer or potentially through the health insurance exchanges. And then Medicaid, which is another government program that is focused on populations that are lower income and cannot afford commercial insurance, or have very complex medical needs.
About how many children in our country are enrolled in this program?
The genesis of Medicaid, one of the core populations back in the 60s when it was established by the government, was to ensure that all children had access to medical care. And believe it or not, over the last several decades, today, nearly 50% of children in the U.S. are covered by Medicaid or another program called the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is similar, offering medical care for children under 18 years of age.
What are the biggest challenges facing parents with kids on Medicaid? They need to get their kid in to see a doctor. I'm going to specifically focus on Florida and South Florida. What is the biggest challenge?
Access to care is an incredibly large barrier for these families, and it really falls into two categories. One is that while 50% of children are covered by Medicaid, generally, if you look at an average pediatrician panel, well under 50% of that panel are children on Medicaid. On average, 15 or 20%. Some pediatricians don't accept Medicaid on their panels, and not enough pediatricians are accepting Medicaid. The second challenge is this has led to what we call pediatric care deserts, where around all major metro areas, if you look at the lowest income communities, the number of pediatricians is about 50% as the higher income zip code. There's actual physical access barriers on top of challenges actually finding a pediatrician who's willing to accept Medicaid.
What about people in rural areas? They may lack access physically to get to a clinic.
Correct. It's rural, but the interesting thing is it's also suburban. So even when you look at communities like Fort Lauderdale, Jacksonville, the pediatricians there tend to be clustered in middle to higher income communities, and lower middle class to low income communities have significantly higher access barriers. And that's true of rural communities, but it's also an urban suburban challenge.
You founded Bluebird Kids Health. You raised $31 million in capital from investors last year. What does your company do, and what is the mission?
Our organization seeks to provide exceptional care so all children can thrive. That's our mission. That's at the core of what we do and how we make all of our decisions. We build retail pediatric practices in large shopping plazas. We locate those in areas that are pediatric care deserts. We map geographies. We look at the number of pediatricians per 1,000 children, and we find the communities that don't have good access today, build a new access point there. And then we ensure that we contract with all the insurance plans in a community. So whether you have a Cadillac commercial insurance product or you're covered by one of the many Medicaid products in the state, you're able to get access at our clinic.
What is your advice for moms and dads with kids on Medicaid? There are no providers, or they're still waiting to get their kids seen.
It really is being a staunch advocate for your children, calling around to all of the pediatricians in the community, calling the pediatricians that are affiliated with local health systems, really knock down the door and be able to get through. Unfortunately, there's not a great secret stash of pediatricians around to be able to get access. It is one where you have to fight for access today. So don't give up. Pediatricians want to do the right thing. They want to provide care for all children. It's just some of the structural barriers around Medicaid reimbursement can make that quite challenging today.
Do you think more should be done on the legislative front to help these children have access to Medicaid?
Access to Medicaid for children generally isn't a huge problem. We're actually pretty good about ensuring that citizen children of the country have access to Medicaid. The challenge and what we need from a policy perspective is more of those dollars to flow through to community-based providers who are really providing this essential frontline proactive preventative care for children and building trust with families so that moms and dads know that they're doing the best thing they can do for their children. Make sure that more of those resources are going to those community-based providers. Create the incentive for more access to democratize the system. As a country, one of the really interesting things is when we look at the life expectancy gaps between the U.S. and other developed countries, most of that delta, 4 or so fewer years that an American is expected to live versus a lot of Western European and other wealthy countries, is driven by circumstances that happen in the first 18 to 21 years of life. We need to make these investments in children. It's how we're going to increase overall life expectancy. An ounce of intervention early really changes the lifelong trajectory of children and is going to help make more thriving communities across the state of Florida, but also across the country.
That was WGCU's Jennifer Crawford speaking with Chris Johnson of Bluebird Kids Health. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, WLRN's Alyssa Ramos introduces us to a South Florida resident who just submitted an entry to NPR's Tiny Desk Contest series.
Between lab results, Katarina Lomas would jot down song lyrics at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. She was working as a cancer research associate, but she was also a singer. Long hours in the lab made it hard to pursue music fully. This year, she took a leap, submitting her work to NPR's Tiny Desk Contest, which showcases independent artists from across the country. I spoke with Katarina about stepping away from STEM and how Miami helped her take music seriously.
I felt like I was actually hurting myself staying in a place where I didn't have the free time to explore, to go try to make those connections, to go see, like, what is my process? What are my goals in music? Like, what do I want to create? And so at some point, it was just realizing I didn't have the time to be able to really work towards both, and I had to make a decision.
Shake our heads, disgrace. Why are the people getting down to the sounds of by the barbershop? Bombastic blues bring everyone down to the grounds about the barbershop. The Gob Show of...
What I love about your music in particular is that the arrangement feels so playful and coy at times. It's very jazzy, very musical theater influenced. Tell me where that came from, like that style. Have you always liked jazz, and when did you want to take that on as your style of music?
In high school, the same teacher that I was doing piano lessons with, she also started teaching me jazz vocals and musical theater vocals and classical. And I never tried to make a certain genre. It was almost like, I think it was just my brain spewing out what it had known.
It's very interesting because I love the storytelling. You're so specific, and even the song Mr. Adams,
yeah.
It's the song that you submitted for your tiny desk.
Mr. Adams always tells me the answers. Mr. Adams never looks me in the eyes.
What was the inspiration for that, and like how did that come about?
This song, like, to this day, I feel like it's one of my favorite songs to write. And I think that one of my favorite things is writing from the point of view of, like, a character that you can just delve into their psyche and, like, create an entire world around it.
Pretty pink pavement kisses my dainty feet.
When I released this song, the feedback that I got was so unexpected, for me at least, because initially I had shared the chorus and people were just like, oh my gosh, like, I love this, you should expand on this song, you should finish it. 6 or 7 months later, when I shared that same segment again, the character sings it, is like her eyes like completely like just open and like almost like haunting. And after releasing it, it just, like, the commentary only got more, like, contradicting. Like, people just had theories about, like, what their interpretation was. And it just blew my mind because as the song existed in the world, I was able to see it through so many different perspectives.
Looking back at the Katarina that got here in 2020, what would you tell her about, you know, the overall South Florida music scene? Like, what would you tell her looking back at her?
Before I came to Miami, I think I was always focused on the voice in music. And then once I got here and I was meeting students in Frost and I was learning about their craft and the amount of time it took, I feel like it opened up a whole new perspective for me and an appreciation for all of the different instruments in a piece or the different production choices or the way a song is mixed. And yeah, I don't think I could have ever anticipated that.
What would it mean for you to win the NPR Tiny Desk contest?
My first thought is I would just message all of my friends and be like, guys, we did it. I feel like it would be such a shared joy. And just to go and share the music, share the love of creating the music.
That was WLRN's Alyssa Ramos speaking with Katarina Lomez. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Tristan Wood, Gina Jordan, and Tom Flanagan. Thanks also to Douglas Soule, Tom Hudson, Jennifer Crawford, and Alyssa Ramos. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. Join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.